Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice-monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey everyone, Watto here, and you are about to hear a fantastic episode of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, talking about alcohol use disorder, hosted by Drs. Carolyn Chan and Sean Cohen. Paul and I love addiction medicine so much that we wanted to bring that mini-series back into the main feed. You can still find all their episodes at Curbsiders Addiction Medicine feed, but we're going to be posting all their new episodes going forward on our feed. So without further ado, enjoy this fantastic conversation on alcohol use disorder.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Life Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
It's so great to be back for Curbsiders Season 4. Really excited to bring a whole new season to you guys out there. And tonight, I'm joined by two incredible co-hosts. So the first one is Dr. Sean Cohen, and the second is America's PCP, Dr. Paul Williams. And on tonight's episode, we'll discuss medications for alcohol use disorder 201, so level two. We're leveling up with Dr. Steve Holtz. And before we get started, Sean, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
Of course I will. We are the Addiction Med Podcast, and we use expert interviews, often with people we look up to, in this case with our friend, Dr. Steve Holt, to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and hopefully inspire listeners to become fierce advocates, become addiction medicine docs, and just help people who use substances. And as a reminder, most of our episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And a special reminder that by listening to this episode and all the addiction med episodes to Curbsiders, and by completing the CME, this can count towards that DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education.
And a special thanks to the Providers Clinical Support System, Medications for Alcohol Use Disorder, also known as PCSS-MAUD, who have partnered with us to support this Curbsiders Addiction Medicine episode. PSSS-MAUD is a national project funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to provide free, comprehensive training, guidance, and mentoring on the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of alcohol use disorder. PSSS-MAUD aims to enhance the capacity of all healthcare professionals to treat individuals with alcohol use disorder, including the use of Food and Drug Administration-approved MAUD. Learn more at www.pcss.maud.
And today we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Stephen Holt, who's an associate professor of medicine and the associate program director for Yale's Primary Care Internal Medicine Residency Program, where his clinical and educational activities revolve around addiction med, physical diagnosis, and medical education more broadly. Currently, he works clinically in an ambulatory clinic where he precepts on as a general medicine ward attendings and as a director of the Yale Addiction Recovery Clinic, a dedicated setting for residents, fellows to manage and provide care to people with substance use disorders, which is where Carolyn and I both met him as he trained us to become the addiction medicine doctors that we are. He's won local and national awards for clinical teaching from the Association for Multidisciplinary Education and Research in Substance Use and Addiction, the Yale School of Medicine, and the American College of Physicians, and created an extensive body of addiction medicine and internal med content for the American Society of Addiction Medicine, Lecturio, and Med Masteries International e-learning platforms, which he tells us is used by over 1 million subscribers. Woohoo!
And tonight, he teaches us about a menu of options for medications that can be used to help patients with alcohol use disorder. So really, today, we go above and beyond just chatting about naltrexone and acamprosate, and we really take a deep dive into disulfiram, topiramate, and some other options. So are you guys ready? Ready to just jump in?
Ready to get the Topa Max out of this episode. No. Okay.
That's not where I thought this was going to go. Welcome. So excited to have everybody today. Steve, this is the round where we like to give our guests a chance to let our audience know them better. Do you mind introducing yourself and giving us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Happy to. So I'm Stephen Holt. I'm a 49-year-old addiction medicine specialist, and I'm an internist. I'm a lover of all things related to physical diagnosis as well. That's kind of my other love in medicine. I'm the father of two teenage daughters, and most folks who know me would agree that I suffer from having too many hobbies and not enough time. So I'm always struggling with deciding where to focus my energies.
What are the top three current hobbies?
Top three board games for sure. Bird watching, which I believe was brought to light in the last time I was here on Curbsiders. And the third one would be I actually love painting miniatures for board games. It's an extra layer of nerddom that I've been doing for basically since shortly before the pandemic, but really dove in during the pandemic, I'd say.
The bird watching was definitely prominently featured in your last episode.
Yeah, we don't need to go there again. Yeah,
I appreciate you adding layers and layers to your personality here for us. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I felt I had to, because honestly, whenever I run into somebody at a conference, nobody remembers anything about the last one, the last podcast, no offense, except the bird watching layer, I guess. It's just the bird watching.
There's a genetic switch that happens at 40-something. I won't give this, but I can tell you on runs, like all of a sudden now I'm like, oh, look, a cardinal. Oh, is that a blue jay? Like I never would have cared 10 years ago. Like,
yeah, I've heard that.
Changed internally, but all of a sudden I was very interested in the birds that were around me. So I think it's just a genetic
switch. Destiny. Yeah, yeah.
I will say, have you seen the ads for the little bird home that has the camera that you can put an
yes,
app on?
Yes.
I thought of you immediately, Steve.
Oh, thank you.
Would like this.
Yeah, I've definitely seen those. Yeah. Not interested, yeah, but I have seen
those.
Yeah.
You have three in your backyard.
Yeah, shut up. Yeah, bird watching.
Okay, but back to asking you questions that are relevant to our podcast. So what are your favorite aspects about working in addiction med?
I would say for me, it's always been, I mean, it's so like cliche, but the rewards of the connections with patients who've spent so many years feeling that there's no way they can connect with people in the healthcare sector. They just don't trust people in healthcare. They don't believe anyone from healthcare will trust them. And so when you actually treat them as human beings and show compassion, and you befriend them and you trust them and they trust you, and you just make these very fast connections with folks in this addiction medicine space that I just find to be profoundly rewarding and humbling. Like, I love sitting in on our group visits and listening to people with addiction sort of tell their story and their insights and the collective wisdom in that room, I just find to be profound. I always think, like, for me, you know, my daily experience, I'm like tackling problems and solving things here and there, you know, doing fun things. For someone with substance use disorder, every day they are struggling against their conscience. And you just gain so much insight when you're fighting a daily battle between what your ideals are, your goals are, your dreams are, and this thing that is drawing you to do something you know is counterproductive. And having that daily battle, I think you just can't help but develop significant insights, even if you continue to struggle. So that's my long-winded answer.
It's a good answer. If I wasn't an addiction medicine doctor, I would want to be one now. So
yes, thank you. Plug for everybody out there. Go into addiction medicine. And I think, why don't we jump into our case from Cashlack? So Sean, do you want to bring us up to speed, give us some updates on some of our patients that we care for at Cashlack?
Yeah, I'd love to. So as a big reminder, if you want to listen to more about medications for alcohol use disorder 101, we do have an episode on the Curbsiders Addiction Med, episode number 4, called Wrapping Our Heads Around Alcohol Use Disorder Meds. very well titled. Not the episode with Steve talking about his bird watching, though. That's the alcohol withdrawal one. But we'll go back to our case. So for our case that we were following from that original episode, we had Miss J, who is a 56-year-old woman. You've been seeing in the office for severe alcohol use disorder. That means her alcohol use is having very negative impacts on her life, has physiologic tolerance, has had withdrawal before, and really impacting her function overall. And after you first met her in the hospital when she was admitted for alcohol withdrawal, she was drinking about a pint of whiskey at that time. A pint is around 8 drinks per day. And her immediate goal was to reduce her use with a long-term goal of eventually stopping entirely. She saw you back in 2022 and trialed acamprosate, which she found ineffective and truthfully couldn't really handle the pill burden as it's a 3-times-a-day medication. And also trialed naltrexone, which she was taking orally daily, was afraid of needles, so didn't take the intramuscular formulation that lasts a month, but found taking it daily led to a ton of nausea she couldn't tolerate. Now, this is a patient that you've known for a couple of years, has trialed on kind of 2 of our first-line medications for alcohol use disorder, and again, that's acamprosate and the oral formulation of naltrexone, but had some barriers to continuing. Are there, when people can't tolerate either naltrexone or acamprosate for the pill burden, naltrexone because of the nausea, do you ever think about alternate ways for them to trial those medications or alternate dosing strategies or other things like that?
Yeah, this may come as no surprise to those who know me well, but I'm going to disulfiram. You know, do not collect $200. Do not pass go. This is clearly a case for disulfiram in my mind. Before I go to disulfiram, I will specifically address your question, though, about whether there's other ways, you know, other ways to do acamprosate or naltrexone. There has been, you know, some scant data looking at 100 milligrams of naltrexone. In her case, that would not be great because she's already having nausea from 50 milligrams. And the data for doing 100 is not great anyway, but I've tried it on a few patients who felt that they got some benefit from naltrexone but wanted a little bit more. That is not, to my knowledge, that is not an FDA-approved dose for naltrexone, but just putting that out there. And then acamprosate, the data, all the studies for acamprosate involved the 600 milligrams TID, or unless you had a renal injury where you can do, you know, half of that. I don't know of any other alternative dosing strategies. The combination of naltrexone with acamprosate, there's really no data to show that that's effective. You know, the combined study back in, I think it was 2006, really looked at that, and it was like 1,000 patients in the study, a bunch of different arms, but adding acamprosate to naltrexone provided no additional benefit. So we don't have any evidence that that would be an appropriate strategy. So for me, no question. Honestly, I probably would have started with disulfiram. That's me. I have a real bend towards disulfiram for a lot of reasons that we may get into during this session, but this is a woman whose professed goal is explicitly abstinence. And that's why I would go with disulfiram.
And I think even taking a step back, as you said, you're trying to align your treatment recommendations with her goals of abstinence. I have to say, I feel like frequently in my practice, it's not always linear where we go from, you know, how many 8 drinks a day to nothing. So I'm just curious, when we think about alcohol use disorder as a chronic disease, what would you consider success for a patient who you're like actively trying to manage?
Yeah, as in all things in medicine, and particularly in addiction medicine, we have a patient-centered focus in all of our goal making and treatment decisions. And you know, there's clear evidence that cutting back from 10 drinks a day to half that or 3 drinks a day or just drinking whatever in moderation clearly has benefits. Even beyond the amount of consumption, another great goal to sort of put on the table with your patient is just safe consumption. And that's, you know, going to mean not operating heavy equipment, not driving, not putting yourself in situations with, you know, going on a date or being around strangers or being in situations where you could be, you know, taken advantage of in some way. I think all of those kinds of those are absolutely potential goals as well, independent of how much somebody is drinking. Maybe it's number of drinking days in a 30-day period. Maybe it's how many drinks you have when you're having a day of drinking, or maybe it's just safe consumption, but it's all on the table. Abstinence should definitely not be a, you know, a black or white thing where that's all we strive for, and anything less than that is a failure.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point to emphasize, because I do think like there is this often very black and white view in society that gets like imposed on people that if you're not abstinent, you're not succeeding with substance use disorders in general, but I think really with alcohol use disorder. And again, there's really good data that drinking reductions improve quality of life, reduce symptoms of substance use disorders, improve mortality, are sustainable. Like, and so like if this patient's goal was just to reduce their amounts of drinks and they're able to do that, it's something that we should work with them for, celebrate with them when they're able to get there and help them kind of get there too. So
yeah, and you kind of still hear that mantra in, you know, AA meetings and some other mutual self-help groups where there's this like, you know, my way or the highway. You're either totally quote clean, end quote, or you're not. And I think one great thing that's happened over the past 10 or 15 years is this proliferation of other mutual self-help groups that have been much more explicitly on board with medication assisted treatment, or I should say more specifically moderation, moderate alcohol consumption or safe alcohol consumption or maintaining sobriety with medication. Like, it's just much more plain, clear language, more plain and clear than the way that I just did it, to sort of say that it's okay if you're on medication to help you to quit drinking. Because I think there's still a lot of the old school folks in AA, you know, still espouse this message of, you know, if you're on medication, you're not really abstinent.
This episode is brought to you by Pretty Litter. Folks, spring is in the air, and I've been desperately looking forward to it. This winter was punishing. I'm so excited to be able to go outside and feel the sun on my skin and smell the smells of nature, things like fresh-cut grass or flowers as they come in. You know what smell of nature I don't love? That would be litter box stink. And with Pretty Litter, that's one less thing that I have to worry about. Pretty Litter obliterates odors so you can enjoy all of the wonderful scents of spring without the perhaps less wonderful smells of a litter box. Pretty Litter's non-clumping formula traps odor and moisture. It's ultra-absorbent, lightweight, low-dust, and 1 6-pound bag works for up to a month. And it can offer you peace of mind. Pretty Litter will change color to indicate early signs of potential illnesses in your cat. Things like urinary tract infections, kidney issues, and more. And perhaps one of my favorite things is that they deliver really right to your door. So for me, everyone's like, oh, cats are easy. But what they don't take into account is the nightmare of litter maintenance, which includes having to like lug these big bags or tubs from the grocery store to your car in the cold and then out of your trunk and into your home and finding some place to keep it. With routine deliveries, Pretty Litter gets rid of all that hassle and makes your life much, much easier. Pretty Litter helps keep your house smelling fresh and clean. Try it and you'll love it. Go to prettylitter.com/curb to save 20% on your first order and get a free cat toy. That's prettylitter.com/curb to save 20% on your first order and get a free cat toy. prettylitter.com/curb. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details. This episode is brought to you by Quince. Folks, it's that magical time of year. The days are getting longer and warmer. The grass is coming in. That's right. It is academic conference season. And if you're anything like me, you're looking forward to traveling to exotic locations like Florida and Colorado and a different place in Florida. And with all this traveling, I am looking forward to treating myself to the luxe upgrades I deserve with Quince's high-quality travel essentials at fair prices. You already know that Quince makes great clothes like lightweight European linen styles from $30, washable silk tops, and comfy lounge sets. But they also make premium luggage options and stylish tote bags to carry that stuff around in. And the best part? All of Quince's items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes on the savings to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I was looking at their website, and they offer full-size luggage, they offer checked bags. I am eyeballing the Napa leather toiletry bag. It is quite sharp and also absurdly affordable. So for your next trip, maybe consider treating yourself to the luxe upgrades you deserve from Quince. Go to quince.com/curb for 365-day returns plus free shipping on your order. That's quince.com/curb to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/curb. Along these lines, can you remind me, and I know this was touched on a Q&A episode that the addiction series did previously, but targeted naltrexone is just, it's not something I think about often, or the so-called Sinclair method. Is that something that you advocate for? Because I've heard it brought up, but it's not something that I hear offered very commonly, at least sort of in the circles that I practice in. So what is the thinking about that? And what are your thoughts in terms of naltrexone as needed prior to alcohol use?
Yeah, so that was most studied with nalmefene, which is a medication not approved in the United States. The equivalent of the FDA in Europe, in the European Union, they have nalmefene and this so-called Sinclair method as an evidence-based option. There actually is some decent data for it. For naltrexone, there's less data. But, you know, in terms of my personal practice, I'm certainly on board with it if that's a patient's goal, right? I mean, some patients will say, you know, I have no cravings to drink except when the holidays come around, except when this anniversary of my dad's death comes around, or except when my friends are in town. And so I want to have this pill that I can take for several days, you know, before, during, and whatever, right after. And I'm obviously going to completely support that decision if that's what they want to do. I think, you know, I'm sure my colleagues, you know, we all sort of generally, we like to use intramuscular naltrexone just because it provides 30-day adherence automatically. But if a patient wants to do this sort of pill in the pocket approach or you know, planned self-administration of naltrexone, then I'm all for it.
Yeah. And just to clarify, so yeah, the targeted naltrexone is naltrexone that you take kind of as needed. If you're anticipating like a trigger, if you're anticipating cravings, or if you know like some kind of event that does that for you is coming up. And so, yeah, I same situations, I use it in either with patients who like really don't want to take a pill every day or don't, are not interested in a medication every day. But I think more for like patients who often aren't drinking every day, but more have these like very kind of discrete events where they're worried that they're going to drink to excess.
I use, or I recommend and have patients have used many times disulfiram in that way too. Because, you know, if you know that when your friends come in town or your this anniversary comes up or whatever it is, or Thanksgiving is coming up and you know you're going to have that conflict with Uncle Bob, taking your disulfiram for a couple of days beforehand, alcohol's now off the menu. Like it's not even something patients are even thinking about because they know they cannot drink. And I find that to be very empowering. Like the patients who I've promoted that and they've done it.
Sounds like you're ready to let us ask you more questions about disulfiram.
Oh, really?
No way. I could not tell that Steve was interested in talking about disulfiram.
Steve, can you tell us a little bit more about the mechanism of action of disulfiram and how you decide to use it and when?
Sure. Disulfiram is an acetaldehyde dehydrogenase inhibitor. A whole bunch of syllables there, but basically it impairs or stops one of the primary steps in the metabolism of alcohol. In your liver, alcohol is converted from alcohol to acetaldehyde, and then from acetaldehyde to acetic acid, and then acetic acid basically just goes out in your urine, and it's not, you know, doesn't have any pharmacological activity that's significant. But acetaldehyde, that is a bad, bad chemical that is very unpleasant to have accumulate in your body. It's believed to be the primary thing that causes a hangover. The toxic accumulation of acetaldehyde causes headaches, flushing, nausea, tremulousness, all these really unpleasant things. It also, by the way, is probably the primary driver of carcinogenesis in a lot of tissues where cancers are related to alcohol consumption. Alcohol does as well, but it's believed that acetaldehyde may be a big contributor. But in any event, when you take disulfiram, you are blocking that step in the metabolic pathway, immediately having the worst hangover of your life within 15 to 40 minutes of consuming alcohol, assuming you're taking the disulfiram. And in many ways, one of the, just to go to cut to the chase, the reason that I believe in disulfiram and a lot of people don't is because of a misunderstanding/misrepresentation of disulfiram in the literature. Most medications that we use are used double-blinded randomized controlled trials. You have, you know, a patient's getting the blue pill, another patient's getting the red pill. No one knows which one is the treatment, which one is the control. The patients don't know. The clinician doesn't know. The investigators in the study don't know. And so you can really see, like, what does this drug do in the target organ if it's the blue one or the red one? With disulfiram, that study design simply does not work because the whole idea of disulfiram is it's a deterrent. It's the threat of drinking alcohol when you're taking this medicine that leads people to abstain. I'm not going to drink alcohol if I don't know if the blue pill is the control or the treatment, because either way, I'm terrified of drinking alcohol. So when you use double-blinded randomized controlled trials, you completely undermine the efficacy of disulfiram. And so in 2014, this is a study that totally changed my opinion of disulfiram. It was Skinner et al. Published this study, this meta-analysis, where they broke up double-blinded RCTs compared with open-labeled RCTs, and the difference in efficacy was profound. I mean, the people who were taking disulfiram and knew they were taking it, who were randomized to that group, as opposed to being randomized to usual care or what have you, had dramatic differences in their abstinence rates or delay till first drink compared with the control groups. And so subsequent sort of studies and other experts have sort of looked at that data and just sort of said, this changes the way that we think about this medication. Unfortunately, you know, that was 2014, that's 10 years ago, but there was 50 years of disulfiram data before that. And I think there's a few generations worth of addiction medicine experts and psychiatrists who have thrown disulfiram under the bus when it's really been just a lack of understanding about the efficacy of this drug. And I should be more specific. It's supervised disulfiram is what's really been shown to be so profoundly effective. And that doesn't mean like having a parole officer watching you take your disulfiram, just having a family member, a friend, maybe your employer in some circumstances, whatever it is, just somebody who's close to you, invested with you in your sobriety. And the evidence for it is very compelling.
Can I raise some of the questions that I hear about disulfiram or that I've heard actually brought up, or maybe even that I have? I guess, yeah. In terms of how you discuss how it works with patients, I guess sort of one of the concerns that I hear about disulfiram, which actually resonates with me a little bit, is, you know, in the addiction medicine space, you're sort of pushing to make this a non-judgmental, non-moralistic sort of, you know, we are treating an illness here, and yet disulfiram seems, of all the choices, punitive, right? Like, so yeah. This is something where if you drink alcohol, you are almost physically punished for it, which I think just kind of is jarring in some ways. And it's certainly not the evidence so much, but it just kind of feels bad, which I know is not the most scientific way to say about it. So when you're having these conversations with patients about starting the medication, like, what does that look like and how do you frame it? Because to me, it seems like, and if you drink, then you're going to get sick. It feels like almost like a reversion back to sort of a more moralistic and sort of judgmental view of addiction than I am comfortable with.
Yeah. No, it's fair. I think it has a lot to do with framing. You know, in psychology, there's really three ways to promote behavior change. There's punishment, there's positive reinforcement, and there's negative reinforcement. And this falls into the punishment category at first blush, because if you take this drug and then you drink alcohol, you will be punished. And, you know, we've evolved in behavioral psychology to know that punishment is not the best way to motivate people to make changes. But on the flip side, it's also providing negative reinforcement, because this is somebody who's suffering from their alcohol use. This is somebody who's seeing you because of complications of this chronic medical disease. By giving them this medication, you're taking away that negative outcome. That's what negative reinforcement is. It's taking away something that's terrible and making your life better, making your experience better. So it's just a little bit about the framing. Yes, this drug will punish you if you drink alcohol, but also, yes, this medicine's really effective and it will help you to achieve your goal, because as many patients, as I alluded to before, many patients tell me as soon as they take their disulfiram in the morning, they are liberated from their cravings. And there's a sense of agency that they have about it. And I mean, I have patients, you know, you may have known in this past 6 or 12 months, there's been a big shortage, like a national shortage of disulfiram. And I've had patients like calling every pharmacy in the state to try and find it because they desperately want it, because they're so afraid of what happens if they don't have it, because it's been so effective for them I had a patient who ordered it from Canada. I mean, that's sort of the level of desperation she was in because she's just seen it to be such a valuable part of her treatment plan.
I think with anything, it's patient-centered, right? Like I have some patients who say, nope, that's just not for me. And I'm totally fine with that. And then some patients say, yeah, I really want to try it daily, or I want to try it in a targeted style. And I say, yeah, that's great. I have some patients who say, I'm worried about this wedding that's coming up. I just want a little extra protection on top of my naltrexone. And I think those are all reasonable ways that patients can choose to use it. I think I just really, in my practice, I like to make sure people, like I'm giving enough information that they're consenting to understand what an adverse reaction looks like. So would you mind, Steve, just going a little bit through, like, what specifically does that reaction look like for patients? Because I think, again, that informed consent piece is just really important for people who opt to do that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, one of the contraindications to using disulfiram is a person who you're concerned about their cognition. You know, if somebody, if you're not 100% sure that they'll remember they took disulfiram in the morning, or they're just struggling to understand the consequences, that's not a game to play. So, you know, patients who I've had who have tested the waters, so to speak, returned to use, have described, and the literature, of course, describes this so-called disulfiram reaction. And it's very much the symptoms I alluded to before. So it's nausea, vomiting, tachycardia, flushing, literally facial flushing, as well as diaphoresis, headaches. I mean, just think of a terrible hangover. I mean, that's really what it is. And it comes fast and furious. I've definitely had patients who've landed in the emergency room. So, you know, again, full disclosure, I've had patients who've ended up in the emergency room, mostly because of the nausea and vomiting, and that can persist for several hours. So it's not, like I said, not to be tread lightly. For folks, and that, you know, thinking of other contraindications, if someone has like already pretty unstable cardiac disease, or, you know, there'd be a real problem with their, you know, ending up having a heart rate of 150 while you're experiencing a disulfiram reaction, I probably don't want to advise disulfiram for that person either.
Are there any other contraindications for this medication besides adverse effects from having, you know, like tachycardia and nausea? Yeah.
So it's not recommended in folks with advanced liver disease. And by that, I mean like definitely Child Pugh class B or C cirrhosis or decompensated cirrhosis. A person who has Child Pugh class A cirrhosis, I have still used disulfiram. I'm monitoring a little bit more than I otherwise might, but I've definitely done it and I will continue to do it. So I'll just make sure I've got a set of LFTs. And I'll probably check after 3 or 4 weeks, make sure things look okay. Realistically, if they're doing fine after 2 or 3 months on it, then I'm confident that they're going to do just fine.
And have you had patients say that they were able to drink on the medication and not have any effect from it? Because I've had this happen in my practice, and then it like loses its efficacy, you know? Just curious on if you've seen this and what do you think kind of causes this to happen.
Yeah, I totally have. And it stumps me every time. And I always feel like, oh, damn, they've robbed themselves of this powerful tool. And it's so haphazard, too. Like, I have trouble really understanding it. This has happened many times because I prescribe a lot of disulfiram. And I've had patients who then just, we ramp up to 500 milligrams. And that seems to work. Like they can take 500 milligrams and then the alcohol becomes even less tolerable. But for some people, even on 500 milligrams, they can drink through it. I don't understand it. But once that happens, the game, you know, the jig is up. This medicine's not going to work for you. And it's unfortunate. And I'm sure it has something to do with, you know, they must have some other mechanism by which they process acetaldehyde or they break up the disulfiram. Who knows? But it doesn't work for everyone.
Some genetic polymorphism that we don't fully understand.
I always hear people talk about this and never know realistically how true it is. But do you warn people about alcohol-containing products like mouthwashes, hand sanitizer, making sure they avoid that kind of stuff? Perfume.
Yeah, I warn patients, but I don't get over the top with it. I mean, patients will say that they've heard that, oh, if they touch like an alcohol hand wash or if they use aftershave or all this stuff. I've yet to have a real convincing story, patient account of anything like that happening. The only real situations I've seen, other than obviously actually consuming alcohol, is if you go to a restaurant and have a meal that's made with some you know sauce that's been, you know, a Marsala wine or something like that. You have to be judicious about some of the sauces and things like that. You know, penne vodka, it's pretty clear what's in there, so be careful for things like that. But I really, and most mouthwashes don't have alcohol in them. I mean, you should take a look, but aftershaves and things like that, I've not really had a convincing story where I've had a patient develop an issue with that. And if you think about it, like pharmacologically, like you're talking tiny little milligrams of alcohol getting into your bloodstream that's going to cause a disulfiram reaction. If you think that you're getting that kind of experience from aftershave application on your face, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, if that's how you're processing alcohol, a beer will just destroy you the next day.
Absolutely, yeah. You are absolutely right. Yeah, you shouldn't drive after using aftershave either.
So I think, like, just to summarize, so it sounds like there is really good data that disulfiram is effective, but in kind of the select situation of someone who has kind of a stable partner, not necessarily romantic partner, but someone who can observe them, kind of keep them honest with taking the medication every day, and in someone who's, like, at least from maybe a cardiac and a liver perspective, a little bit more medically stable as well, and probably from, like, a housing perspective and that kind of thing too.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so that's sort of my first line medication, frankly. And then if I don't have a person who can play a role, you know, a support person, if I don't have abstinence as a goal, if I do have very advanced liver disease or advanced cardiac disease or cognition issues, then I go to the rest of my armamentarium. That's how I think about it.
And let's say our patient does not have somebody who kind of is close contact and help her engage with disulfiram, so she feels like it's probably not the best medication for her. Now we're kind of moving into the kind of quote-unquote off-label medications, medications that are not FDA approved. Do you have a spiel that you give people of, like, hey, there's some other medications, they're not actually FDA approved, or do you kind of, like, how do you talk about that? Or do you talk about that, I guess, with patients at all before talking to the meds?
Yeah, it's probably, I can't say, I definitely don't do it all the time, that I sort of clarify FDA approved or not FDA approved. I mean, most people don't care, at least most patients that I've taken care of don't seem to care one way or the other. But I do it sometimes. I don't know. It's probably, I don't know what your experience is. There's so many medications that we use off label. And I don't know that if I'm not using a medicine that's particularly toxic, like some chemotherapeutic, I don't think that I get too into the weeds about FDA approval or not. Personally, maybe I should.
So Steve, what are the next medications you reach for in your algorithm? So we've already moved past the disulfiram, naltrexone, and camprasate. What are the next group of medications that you may consider offering a patient?
Yeah, so there's a host of medications that are not FDA approved, but have pretty compelling data in support of them, enough that, for example, topiramate, which we'll talk in a second about, is approved in Europe for this indication. And I also believe the VA guidelines here in the United States endorse topiramate, which I always thought was interesting since it's not FDA approved, but the VA health system endorses it as first line. So I'm not sure how all that works. But yeah, so the medicines are topiramate and gabapentin are probably our most prominent second line, or I should say non-FDA approved medications. Whether or not they're second line or not, we can discuss. And then beyond that, there's some data for varenicline, ketamine, psilocybin. The GLP-1s are sort of getting a lot of attention. Baclofen, prazosin. That's probably most of the main ones that have been studied in some detail. Just to focus on topiramate first, which I would say of all the ones I just mentioned, I probably have the most confidence in topiramate in the non-FDA approved camp. There's been a couple of meta-analyses looking at topiramate, some quite recently, that really do show that it has a moderate effect size on reducing number of heavy drinking days, reducing the amount that one drinks on a drinking day, and some abstinence data as well. You know, when it comes to alcohol studies, we look at all these things like abstinence, reduction in heavy drinking days, percent heavy drinking days, how much do you drink when you drink, as well as some more sort of liver marker kind of studies as well. And in that vein, topiramate was shown to reduce GGT, for example, the sort of marker of liver inflammation. So it's definitely got compelling data to support it. I think maybe it will at some point become FDA approved. The only real limitation with topiramate, and the reason that I don't get it out there first line very often, is you're twice as likely to have, like in the research that's looked at topiramate, you're twice as likely to have people drop out of the study compared with placebo because of side effects. So you have to start on a really low dose. It's like 25 milligrams twice a day. You titrate up over sometimes 8 weeks, sometimes even longer, to get to a treatment dose of at least 200 milligrams a day. Some people would even say 300 milligrams in a day. And that takes a long time if you're only going up by an extra 25 milligram tablet a week. So again, like 25 and 25 for a week, then 25 and 50 for a week, then 50 and 50 for a week, then 75 and 50, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to get to either 100 twice a day or even as much as 150 twice a day. And you'll find that there's just a point at which the patient feels, they're starting to feel sluggish, they're feeling maybe some paresthesias, you know, funny taste sensation, or, you know, just having trouble concentrating. So I like topiramate. It, you know, it's got some good data for stimulant use disorder as well, you know, so it's something that I definitely use in my practice. But I just find sometimes patients have sometimes struggle with that kind of slow titration. And it's also hard to follow, right? You tell a patient that every single week you're going to be in a different amount of this medication. That's hard for folks to attend to, I find.
This episode is brought to you by ACP Internal Medicine Board Review Course. Be thoroughly prepared to ace the ABIM board exams after attending an ACP Internal Medicine Board Review Course, in person or via live stream. The course is offered in two locations, Greater Chicago and Philadelphia. The course is recommended as a trusted resource for the LKA, ABIM MOC exam, or the initial ABIM certification exam. This 5-day intensive course is taught by over 17 clinician educators. The course covers topics aligned with the ABIM exam blueprint. Learners can assess their knowledge through interactive, case-based questions, and faculty provide valuable tips on test-taking strategies to strengthen your confidence. Registration includes 6 months free access to course recordings so learners can review and reinforce concepts. And attendees can earn CME and MOC credit. The proven ACP board review course is backed by ACP's Exam Preparation Guarantee. The course is offered in the Greater Chicago area May 13th through 17th and, new for 2025, Philadelphia from July 14th through the 18th. Registration is open now. Save $75 when registering for the Philadelphia course by June 1st. Enter code COURSECS25. That's course CS25. This episode is brought to you by Easy Resus. Easy Resus is your ultimate support to take care of your sickest patients during resuscitation. Whether you are taking care of a newborn during a precipitous delivery, a septic child requiring endotracheal intubation, or a seizing teenager, this offline app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, and treatment algorithms all available in under 3 clicks. This gives you rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface, taking care of the logistics of resuscitation so that you can take care of what really matters, your patient. For those who do not work with critically ill patients, the app also has calculated doses of the most used PO and IV medications, including antibiotics and analgesia. Also, you can find critical first steps for basic and advanced life support, which could be useful for anyone anywhere. Finally, for those who work with adult patients, there is a complete adult section with the same features as in pediatrics, including weight-adjusted dosing for obese patients, treatment algorithms, and more. Someday, you'll need to act outside of your comfort zone. With Easy Resus, you'll be ready. Easy Resus was made for all clinicians with a user-friendly interface with 100% offline content and available on any device. It includes drug dosing, treatment algorithms, and equipment size that are dynamically calculated based on patient characteristics. Easy Resus has multiple alerts and content are adjusted to age and weight to ensure safety. The content is entered and reviewed by over 30 healthcare professionals. It is available for institutional access, including an online version, group pricing, customizable content, and exclusive features. Listeners of the Cribsiders and the Curbsiders podcast get access to a 2-month free trial, letting them use 100% of the features of the app. Download Easy Recess on the App Store or Google Play Store. Create your account, use promo code Cribsiders or Curbsiders, and start using Easy Recess. For more information, visit easyrecess.com/Cribsiders or www.easyrecess.com/Curbsiders. And for learners, including students and residents, the app is completely free for the first 2 years.
When I'm like working in the hospital and seeing patients particularly that have like very severe cirrhosis and concomitant renal failure, like it's often one of the few medications that you can use, although you have to dose adjust in renal insufficiency and is completely liver safe. Although I think more and more data is coming out that now naltrexone is probably safe in most stages of liver disease as well at this point, even decompensated cirrhosis. But that is one situation where sometimes I reach for topiramate too.
Yeah, topiramate, gabapentin, and acamprosate are really don't have any liver clearance at all. I think gabapentin might be 10% liver clearance or something, but it's very small, whatever it is. So they're all pretty safe in advanced liver disease. So they are good in those situations, I agree. And then pivoting to talk about gabapentin is a good example of where I think the addiction medicine community, we all got super excited by this paper. I think it was in 2012. It was by Mason et al., 2010 or 2012. And I was like, oh my God, number needed to treat of 5? This is going to cure addiction. I didn't say that. But we were so excited about it. I think it was a number needed to treat of 5 for abstinence and a number needed to treat of 3 or something ridiculous to like show evidence on decreased heavy drinking or decreased number of drinks per day or something like that. And like so often happens, I'm sure this comes up all the time in Curbsiders, sometimes that initial enthusiasm is not followed up by more studies that confirm those initial, you know, very exciting findings. That's the gabapentin story. I mean, you know, it was only a few years later that somebody tried to repeat that study, and then there was a meta-analysis, and it just showed it was not the like the home run that we all thought it was. And so I've backed off on prescribing gabapentin. I still use it. I use it a lot for alcohol withdrawal, which is a whole different topic. And I use it, you know, the data shows that it's probably most effective for folks with a history of alcohol withdrawal. You know, someone who's had alcohol withdrawal symptoms is probably going to benefit the most from maintenance therapy with gabapentin. But yeah, it's not the heavy hitter that I think we once, the way that we once felt about it. I don't know, did you guys have a similar experience with gabapentin and your feelings towards it?
I have to tell you, so I have a 9-year recorded history of bashing gabapentin. Like I've been slagging it for almost a decade. And I've actually become a believer with alcohol use disorder. It is the one circumstance where I've actually seen the medication have some degree of efficacy. Usually, nice. I will use it to like augment naltrexone, but it is the one medication that I feel is fairly consistent of the ones that I've actually worked with.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. We're still believers out there. And like I said, I'm a big believer in it for alcohol withdrawal, like outpatient managed withdrawal. I use it a lot, but I tend to transition from gabapentin to something else shortly after.
I think I've had similar experiences, particularly for like reduction in use. And I think because it's hitting some other like co-occurring conditions that patients may have, like untreated anxiety, like they are having withdrawal symptoms. So it like kind of helps temper those. So it makes it easier to space out their drinks because they're just not so uncomfortable. I don't feel like I've had as much success in abstinence, but also a lot of patients have alcohol-induced neuropathy. So I feel like it. They have told me it like has helped some of their neuropathy symptoms. And I'm like, wonderful, because that sounds like uncomfortable as well. So not against treating that with that medication at all either.
Yeah, anytime you can go, you know, 2 birds with 1 stone. I hate that metaphor, actually. Who's killing all these birds with the stones?
It really seems like a metaphor you particularly would dislike.
Yeah. Yeah, really. I don't know why.
Leave those poor birds
out of my mouth. Yeah.
And again, I hesitate to sing the praises too much, but I also feel like so much of alcohol use I see is used to treat insomnia, which is probably actually the result of the alcohol use disorder in the first place. So gabapentin is also can be helpful for sleep when alcohol had traditionally been used for that. So I see the same kind of reductions that Carolyn's talking about.
True.
And what doses are you guys using? I feel like I have to crank up the dose. Like 100 TID isn't going to cut it.
Yeah, I know that initial study and most of the subsequent stuff was 300 milligrams TID for a couple days and ramping up to 300 TID and then to 600 TID. Yeah, it was 600 milligrams TID was the target dose. I agree with you, Carolyn. I've definitely used some higher doses, and I think some subsequent studies have shown that it's perfectly safe to come out the gate much stronger than just 300 milligrams TID. You know, somebody who's drinking two pints of vodka a day, they can handle 1800 milligrams of gabapentin pretty quickly. But yeah, that's about as high as I go, is 900 TID, I think.
And it's worth emphasizing a point Paul made too, is I think of the medications you can combine, naltrexone and gabapentin, I think, is the only combination that has at least a little bit of supportive data compared to the others that maybe don't have some data.
Yeah, there's all these like little studies that have combined X and Y that I've seen, and they, you know, tend to be, you know, like 30 patients. You know, there's like naltrexone and prazosin, there's acamprosate and disulfiram, there's naltrexone and varenicline. There's just all these little studies, and they don't get repeated, and they're too small, and they tend to not be great study designs sometimes. So we don't have a lot of good stuff to say combination pharmacotherapy works, but God knows I do it all the time. I just think, you know, it's so easy to give somebody a shot of naltrexone and then give them some disulfiram. That's probably my cocktail if a patient's on board with that plan. But yeah, there's not a lot of data to show combination pharmacotherapy. Not to say that, you know, evidence of lack is not lack of evidence, or vice versa. But yeah, just to quickly go through the other ones then. So, you know, varenicline, also there was some reasonably exciting data for a while, but, you know, most recent meta-analysis really shows varenicline's probably not going to be a home run either. Maybe, I mean, I use a lot of varenicline for tobacco use cessation, so I'm obviously happy to use that, but I'm going to use another tried and true drug for AUD at the same time. Prazosin, very limited data. Maybe it's an adjunct to naltrexone based on a little study that I saw. GLP-1s, so that's all the rage. What's going on with the GLP-1s with the semaglutide, et cetera? You know, I sort of view it similar to like the gabapentin excitement, right? We were so gung-ho, high as a kite, thinking about what gabapentin was going to do. I'm very cautious now. And until there's a really large, well-controlled, double-blinded, randomized controlled trial with an actual primary outcome that's about alcohol, as opposed to most of these studies are the primary outcome was not alcohol, so there were secondary outcomes, or they're retrospective, or a lot of them were in animal studies. I mean, that's just not, you know, we can't rely upon that stuff and get super excited about them yet. That's my feeling. I don't know if you guys have started to get the bug for GLP-1s yet.
I want to get the bug. I want to be excited about it. Yeah. So I am going to be excited about it. Let's not rain on the parade until we know.
Fair enough.
There's no way an insurance company is going to pay for it anyways right now for that indication. So, you know, let us keep our hope.
I hope. Yeah. I have
it's
hope.
It's one of those other things, same with varenicline, is if you have a good indication to use it. And then hopefully it has a beneficial side effect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Last one you mentioned earlier was baclofen. Is that part of your armamentarium or not so much?
I confess I haven't really used baclofen much at all. I mean, I could probably count on one hand the number of times I've used it. Every time I have somebody like tell me like, oh, there's great evidence for it, and I get excited and I look into it and I find like, oh, wow, there really is a great meta-analysis that baclofen works. And then I'll look at another one that completely trashes it. So there's a lot of inconsistent data around baclofen. I know that hepatologists are very excited about it. Europe is very excited about it. They use it a lot. I'm just not seeing consistent data to support it. But hey, if nothing else is working, by all means, try baclofen. I mean, it seems like it's reasonably safe. It has similar side effect profile to topiramate. But that's my feelings about it.
And I think it's just nice to kind of review all of these options, because it's definitely like not a one size fits all for patients. Sometimes I have found combination therapy to be helpful for a certain person. So it's good for people to know, hey, these are options. You can consider these, work with the patient closely to see what like meets their needs, their lifestyle, their goals, and letting patients know that if one med doesn't work, there are other options, I think is really helpful to tell people up front. So that way they're not like, well, it didn't work. I'm never going to come see you again. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I try and set some expectations, you know, that like there are other
totally
options.
Agree.
And for some people, this is really helpful. And for others, we may try something else. So yeah. That way, hopefully people come back to my clinic visits.
I so agree. Yeah. Just like so many medicines, you know, this isn't all I have. If it doesn't work, please come back. And just to highlight the, you know, so many patients have issues with medication adherence. And that's one of the things I love about oral naltrexone and oral disulfiram. It's one pill a day. It's just compared with topiramate and gabapentin and acamprosate, where you've got all these dose changes and definitely multiple times per day. And it's just kind of tedious and hard for a lot of folks to follow through with. So as an aside, do you know that in Europe, I only recently found this out a couple months ago, there is an approach using disulfiram under the skin, implantable disulfiram tablets that they put in for a year at a time, and the abstinence rates are staggering. Now, I'm ready to get behind Big Pharma for this. If someone in the United States is ready to go, I will take your money. I will take your free lunch, and I will be behind implantable disulfiram. I'm kidding about that part, but I really do wish Pharma would get on board with some longer acting formulation.
Totally agree, and I think we've spent honestly the majority of our time talking about medications here. But do you want to do a quick pitch too on like what other facets of treatment you may consider, any psychosocial supports for patients?
It's worth mentioning, we sort of alluded to this before, but mutual self-help groups, there is a incredible diversity of them now for like every spiritual persuasion or secular persuasion. There's some that are like CBT based and very pragmatic, skills focused, and then there's some that are based on physical activity and getting out there with communities of people who are just want to get physically moving. I just think there's so many options out there, and in general the evidence supports them. They're as effective as seeing a clinical psychologist longitudinally, and they're generally free, widely available. There's just something about being part of a community, contributing to that community, which I think is so meaningful for patients when they can take themselves out of themselves and focus on what they can do for another person who's in recovery. So I strongly support the importance of that of mutual self-help groups, whatever spin, whatever type your patient may be into.
And I always like to, it's always worth taking a step back and like, I mean, fortunately and hopefully during this process, you've kind of gotten to know your patient and gotten to know like the underlying things that have led to them drinking too. And that like part of our job is trying to help address whether it's trauma or untreated depression or anxiety, and working to like in an evidence-based manner, address those things and kind of treat the whole person you're treating too.
Yeah. And we know that the addition of evidence-based behavioral therapies to pharmacotherapy is generally useful. It adds something to outcomes. So absolutely, we need to make sure that we're offering some of those evidence-based behavioral treatments, whether it's CBT or motivational enhancement therapy, community reinforcement approach, all those kinds of things, because they work for all comers probably, but particularly, like you said, for the folks who have underlying mental health disorders. Yeah.
We've covered so much ground here today. Is there anything else? Any other, any burning questions we should ask Steve before we sort of bring it home and ask him for some take home points?
What's your favorite bird, Steve?
It's the tundra swan. The tundra swan.
I'm there glad you had an answer. I was
That's
a little worried.
Answer.
Good,
yeah.
Good.
And on that note, can you share with us some take-home points?
Sure. I actually will take a point that you made because I think it's so important, which is this idea that when you start a patient, after you have a conversation with a patient about the menu and you select something, just makes your patients understand there is a whole menu. If this doesn't work, please come back. We've got a lot of different things to try. I think there's always the risk that patients start to, when they hear you're going to try something on them, they start to get this, oh, I'm a guinea pig mentality. And sometimes you have to really diffuse that. But just to emphasize that, you know, these meds work, but it's hard to know which person they're going to work for. And I hope that this works for you, but please let's try that. Let's try the next one if this doesn't work. Second key point is I think formulation really matters, and adherence to medication is predicated on how accepting a patient is of taking a medicine once a day, twice a day, three times a day, dosing that's changing over time versus an injectable. So if this isn't just, here's three different drugs and here's their mechanism of action, here's three different drugs that are kind of taken in completely different ways. And so really talking to the patients about that and making sure that that's part of their decision-making. It's not just the mechanism of action. And I don't know, what's the third take-home point?
That I should look up what a tundra swan is.
Beautiful bird. Beautiful bird. You're going to be moved to tears when you see a couple good pictures.
Oh, I found it.
Or I think just
Google.
I loved your point specifically at the very beginning, which I know was not one of the intentional teaching points, but just the joy of actually doing this kind of work and working with patients and fostering relationships and just how rewarding it is, I think is... So the medications are great, but also just getting to work with patients in this way is also sort of satisfying. Not to steal your thunder, but I love that point that you made. I just want to emphasize and underscore that too.
Thanks, Paul.
And tundra swans are cool too, I'm sure.
Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on again.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. And really love this podcast, and I'm happy to be a part of it. Thanks so much.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We are committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com.
And a special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams, who got to join us today, for their support on this project, as well as the Providers Clinical Support System Medications for Alcohol Use Disorder, also known as PCSS-MAUD. Learn more about that organization at www.pcss-maud.org. A special thanks to the whole team that worked on this episode. The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at PodPace. Until next time, I've been Sean Cohen.
And a reminder that this and most of our episodes are available for CME credit for healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thanks for joining us and letting us bring you some addiction medicine pearls.